You're listening to Two Guys Talking Wine with Michael Pincus and Andre Prue.
Hello, Michael.
Hello, Andre. I
feel like I haven't spoken to you in weeks.
I think it has been weeks.
It's actually kind of funny. Like yesterday, we were just trying to coordinate a time when we could connect, and it was like almost like an Abbott and Costello bit. And the thing is, like, you and I both have moments where we get a little grumpy with each other. Although lately, it's been me getting grumpy with you, and it got to the point where I was just like, Michael, I'm not actually crabby with you. I just don't understand what's going on. Like, let's sort it out.
Well, I was trying to tell you where I was going to be, and you were like, now? And I'm like, no, tomorrow.
So I mean, that's the thing, is if people haven't figured out, you're on the road.
I am.
Where are you?
Well, right now I'm in Bologna Airport, henceforth the Ciao Mio podcast partner. It's like it's 11:30 at night, and I'm waiting for a 1 o'clock bus. I decided to go and scout out the selection of Pringles at the in the grocery store in the airport, and I found
the paprika flavored.
Yeah,
that's like very like sort of European thing. You can find those sometimes in Hamilton at like Starsky or like one of the specialty European stores down here.
Yeah, they had paprika. They have the usual flavors. They had smoky bacon, and I was like, well, I don't know if I want smoky bacon.
So you were recently somewhere that makes wine that we don't hear a lot about in North America.
No, actually, we used to all the time. So I was in Cyprus, and I first of all, I had no idea where Cyprus was.
Okay, well, let me ask you.
I thought it was all.
Now it's time for you to put up with my bad millennial references here. Did you stand on the hill? Did you stand on Cyprus Hill?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Did you go a little crazy there? Were you insane? In the membrane?
I was a little insane in the old membrane.
Insane, yeah. In the brain?
And in the brain.
Okay. I've got it out of my system.
Okay.
Okay. So tell me. Okay. So, where is Cyprus, first off?
Wait. So do you know? Like, literally, do you know?
Only because you told me. Like, it was one of these things where, like, when you told me you were going to Cyprus, like, I imagined it being, like, right close to Greece. Like...
That's what I always thought it was.
Like I thought it was like
Turkey.
Yeah, I thought it was actually like part of Greece.
I did too. Which is the funny part. It's right underneath Turkey. It's basically on the way to the Middle East. Like right now Cyprus is in the middle of one of those moments where cruise ships, which usually go to Cyprus and then they go to Israel and then they go to Egypt,
are just stopping there.
Cruise ships are not stopping because they're not going that way anymore. For the moment, obviously.
Yeah, so just to take a look at a map, Cyprus is a fairly large island given, like, what part of the Mediterranean it's a part of. And the closest countries to it all sound like places you'd want to be right now. We got Turkey to the north, Syria to the east, Lebanon to the east, Israel,
yep,
to the southeast, and Egypt to the, yep, south. So
Turkey's to the north, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I said Turkey to the north. So
okay, got it.
Before we get into the wines, just because as everyone who's listened to this podcast knows, I'm always a big fan of the like the enotourism part of that. What is the feeling of people in Cyprus, like, with the conflict in Israel taking place right now? Like, is it something that is really front of mind for them, or is it something like you didn't hear anything about?
I didn't hear anything about it. It was, this thing was all about wine. They were all about talking about Cyprus. The only thing I really heard about it was that the cruise ships aren't coming in, and that's bad for their tourism, obviously. You didn't hear anything about it. There's two British army bases or military bases on Cyprus.
Okay.
And we actually drove through both of them at one point, but you couldn't tell. It was really weird. So, yeah, like you didn't see a military presence kicking around, but I guess there's a road that just drives right through them. I guess it's not like the heart of the military base, but there are roads that you have to get on. And then the military, if they stop you, they are the ones who will issue you the tickets or give you the fine or whatever it is.
Oh, interesting. All right, so you know what? Let's dive right into the wine part, because you said we used to hear more about Cypriot wine in Ontario, but not so much anymore. What up with that?
Well, we would have received wine from them. Like let's go. Like, first of all, Cyprus's wine history goes back like 6,000 years. Let's start there with a wine called Commanderia, which is a sweet wine that is basically they harvest the grapes and they dry them in the sun. There is an element of that that goes back into their history, granted 6,000 years, but back in like 1930s, 40s, 50s, Cyprus was like the place for bulk wine, especially sweet wine. They were making sweet sherries. They were also growing grapes for raisins. They were making all kinds of spirits with the grapes. They just were like awash with grapes. And what ended up happening was they had so much, and that, times changed. First of all, they were sued by Spain. It was called, Cypriot sherry or something like that, or whatever mm-hmm. name they had given it. And Spain sued them and said, you can't call it sherry. So there goes that market. And then people started to change their ways of drinking. They didn't want to drink sweet wine anymore, as you know, we know in Canada with ice wine. And port drinkers are few and far between these days. Sherry drinkers are few and far between these days. So you end up with a consumer base that now wants dry wine. Well, these guys are making sweet wine. So that market kind of dries up. And they used to take this stuff out in tankers. There are actually pictures of, big, huge boats being filled up that looks like they're being filled up with gasoline or oil. And it's actually wine that's being put into these massive hulls of these ships. And they were sent all over the place because bottling wine was not part of Cyprus's way of making wine. They just made it in bulk and it got bottled wherever it went. And I did see a label at one of the places that the guy had from Canada. There was stuff being sent to the UK. There was stuff being sent to Spain. There was stuff being sent to France. And a lot of this stuff also was used as filler for some wineries too. So lots of bulk wine was went through Cyprus.
I always find that the history of like bottling and bottling product like so incredibly fascinating, right? Like you see on French bottles, mise en bouteille à la propriété, like that is something where I think in 2024 we sort of take for granted that we expect our wines to be bottled at the place that it's made. And like even in Ontario, like, you know, once you get a little closer to the industry, you know about the magic truck that shows around. And even though a lot of small wineries don't own their own bottling truck, things get like bottled there. But like, it's just, I don't know, it's fascinating when you hear about the history, like for Bordeaux, you know, going back to when Bordeaux became the region of prestige that it is, bottling at the chateau was a way of protecting the quality of your product, where if you shipped a barrel to the UK where they were drinking a lot of Bordeaux, other things could potentially be put into the bottle when people were getting it ready to be sold. So I don't know, it's always just fascinating to hear about like that whole concept of transporting bulk goods all over. I mean, it's got to be a nice thing too to keep your overhead down. Like if you're running a Cypriot winery, you don't have to pay for bottles, corks, labels, any of that. You just need to fill the tanker.
Well, so but that's now changed. That's the old history of Cyprus. And I guess what the EU decided, because they are part of the EU, that they were going to start they were gonna kind of curb them and their winemaking. So about 30 years ago, just checking my notes here, they ripped up about 80 to 90% of their vines.
Oh,
like they just started ripping them up.
Were the wines that they were making like all these old school? We'll just call them old school wines. Was it vinifera that they were using? Like, was it vinifera that they ripped up?
No.
Okay, so what was it like? Similar to in Ontario, like.
So they have the big mainstay grape that they had at the time was called Mavro.
Okay,
and they just it's a from what it was described to me as it's a big fat grape, which they could make anything out of. They could make wine from it. They could make, as I said, raisins. They could make spirits. There's this. They kept calling it a cream when we went to this place. It was a sweet, and basically what they do is they take the grape, the interior, I guess, and they boil it down and boil it down and boil it down till it looks like it almost looks like caramel. But it's made from the interior of a grape and the pulp. And
sorry, Michael, just a quick correction here. Like, this is fascinating. Granted, it's Wikipedia. I punched in the word Mavro, indigenous red grape cultivated on the island of Cyprus, and it is Vitis vinifera.
Oh, okay. So that's interesting to know. It's probably they are Vitis vinifera, but we don't hear about them. So, like, not that Mavro is being grown anywhere else, but
yeah.
But I tried some wine from the grape. It's a very, put it this way, it makes kind of a, I would say a very light Gamay-ish kind of wine.
Oh,
very light, though.
Better or worse than Baco?
I liked it better than Baco.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, it's not something they want to hang their hat on. So, yeah, about 30 years ago, they started doing this big rip up. So it's really interesting as you're driving along, because it's a very mountainous area. And you see all these terrace vineyards without vineyards on them, like no vines. So there's lots of terraces, lots of places you can recognize as a vineyard. Like if you've ever been to Germany and you've seen those vineyards on high hills and stuff like that, you'd go, oh, okay, yeah, that's definitely a vineyard. But you're looking at them and they're like, there's no vines on them. So they were just totally, totally ripped out. And then there's this kind of new generation. So I guess in Cyprus, there was four major wine companies that were making this sweet crap wine. That was sent all over the world. One of them still exists. It's called Keo. They actually did make the switch to, let's call it fine wine. Then you have three of the other companies. One of them definitely went broke. The other one, the guy kind of skated over. You know, he said, and this company, and blah, 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 blah. And then there's a fourth company that just made the pivot to making spirits and never looked back. They didn't do wine. So winemaking now is made by, I guess, it starts with like fathers and sons. So the father starts a winery because he worked for one of these big four wine companies, or he was in the wine business growing for a while and decides that he's now going to make the pivot with his son to you know, create a proper winery. You can probably now hear the behind me as the announcements are being made at an airport as well.
It's all good.
And so what we get now is what they did was, when they started doing some kind of replanting, they did. They started with like Cabernet Sauvignon, Shiraz, Sauvignon Blanc was big, Merlot. They wanted to get the international varieties in there, and they were all from cuttings. And here's the interesting part: is Cyprus has no phylloxera.
Yep.
And the weirdest part about that is that one of the winemakers admitted, he goes, "It's not because we were really smart; we just got lucky."
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd be curious. Do they have sandy soils? Is that like the
nope? Big... Lots of clay soils.
Oh, interesting.
Lots of really crappy soils and volcanic soils as well. a lot of magma within the soils. They're doing a lot of high elevation. They have some of the highest elevations in Europe for growing grapes. Their highest vineyard is 1,535 meters.
So
they're growing grapes at.
Yeah. So like maybe not to bury the lead a bit, but we describe the geography of like where Cyprus is located, and in my mind, I imagine that place being hot as hell. Like, it seems like every summer at some point we hear about heat waves in Greece. I know my father-in-law visited Turkey during the summer, and he commented on how hot it is, like to the point where, a lot of like restaurants and markets are open overnight just to like give people some relief from the heat. How do you make wines with balance when you're on an island that's that far south? Like, or does the sea just help moderate the climate? Like fill me in here. What's going on?
Well, you have hit it. The sea does help moderate. Nobody ever mentioned anything like 40 degrees. They're talking like temperatures around 35. They got great diurnal temperatures, first of all. And when you're making it, at high elevation, obviously you're getting cooler temperatures there. So they're talking about, during the day, they'll get, 25, 30. And then at night, it'll go down to 18, 17. At harvest time, that's probably where it's probably the hottest. It's probably around 35. And it's really interesting because what they do is they bring the grapes to the winery and they immediately throw them into a fridge overnight to chill them down, or else they're going to have some problems.
Yeah.
And that was something that I think happens at like every one of these wineries, is that they have this large fridge to chill these grapes, and they have to be chilled overnight or these things will just, start to ferment immediately.
Yep. Yeah. Cool. What do like, okay, let's go like top down. Let's go really broad, and then we'll unpack some specifics here, because I know like you tagged me in a couple of posts, brought a few things to my attention. If you were describing a general trend in Cypriot wines, like how would you describe them? Because once again, I'm taking a look at, the description of Mavro. I'm taking a look at what they have planted, and like their top plantings are Mavro, Carignan, Palomino, which I've never heard of, but Cabernet. So I see Grenache on the list. I see Syrah on the list. Like, as you mentioned, like I'm imagining like Southern Rhone style wines, big, juicy, opulent, like fruit bombs. Was that what you found there?
So let's start with their Shiraz. A lot of winemakers say Shiraz.
No. I said we're going to go individual after this. I want the overview. I want like if you're talking about like a general trend, is there a general trend?
So
I can't believe that I actually managed to stop you there and you didn't just step all over me.
So the general trend is for indigenous grape varieties.
Okay, cool.
First of all, it is getting away from the international grapes. They still use them. They still make them. They sometimes use them in blends. But they are, the trend now is to go indigenous, because they do have some very interesting indigenous grape varieties. They've also stopped any kind of importation of grapes. So they have to, they have a very strict quarantine if they are going to bring anything in. I believe it's about 5 years that they have to quarantine anything before it'll go into the ground. But what they're doing is they're taking cuttings from their own vines and literally just, shoving them into the ground and hoping they take root. One of the wineries we were at said he gets a rate of about 90% when he's doing that of survivability. But it is indigenous grape varieties, because they're learning that, well, first of all, they only have about 14 indigenous grape varieties. Did they have more? Nobody knows. Nobody did any DNA testing on these things, but they do know that they do have about 14 grape varieties that are indigenous, of which I'm going to go half that number. I think they're using to make wine with at the moment.
Interesting. Okay, so I guess let's go down from there, though. Like, we're working with indigenous varieties, which, like, can be hit or miss. Like, when we have a palate that's a little bit more climatized to, I guess, what's now being referred to as the international varieties. Did you have some favorites? Like, and how is it and how were your favorites treated? Was there a commonality? You know, are you seeing funky amphoras where the winemakers in Cyprus are dancing around them, or is it more of a conventional, let's just say, French and Italian inspired way of winemaking? Let's get into some, some details here.
It's interesting. So let's start with those international varieties. I did try a little bit of Shiraz. A lot of them are very excited, and they do call it Shiraz there, not Syrah. They are very excited about Shiraz because they think it's one of those the international grape variety that does probably the best of any of them there. It takes to the land really well, and it's the easiest grape to grow. Like, it just never needs anything. It seems to be well suited for their climate. So they love working with Shiraz when they can. I did try Cabernet Sauvignon. I thought it was good. But yes, I think they can get a little more opulent in the international varieties. They're doing some nice Sauvignon Blanc. And obviously, because at high altitudes, Sauvignon Blanc is going to take on some of that great acidity, and they're getting some ripeness. So it's not the New Zealand style Sauvignon Blanc that you hate. So as we start digging into their into their indigenous varieties, there's things like Zinisteri, which is a white, and the name actually means low or lacking acidity. So yippee!
I mean, that can not necessarily be like a bad thing on a hot summer day, right?
Well, if handled correctly, I found that first of all, they do acidify a little bit, like, you know, 0.1 or just a little bit to add some acidity to the grape, or they'll blend it with Sauvignon Blanc to give it that acidity. But it's kind of a fun little grape because they can do a lot of things with it, and it is indigenous. And there was one winery, if you'd allow me just a second here, to come up with their name, because they did a really cool, could have been Best Silicon. Yeah, hold on.
Yeah, I'm looking up. So they're saying there is actually not a whole lot about Zinisteri on Wikipedia, which, by the way, for people listening to this, Wikipedia is not a preferred source. I'm just kind of flying along to read along with what Michael's been doing here. But one thing it does say in the Wikipedia article is that it's well known for its durability against diseases. Okay, and the source material on that is, did you go to Vuni Panea Winery?
I did not.
Okay,
didn't even hear about that one.
That's the source that is quoted on the Wikipedia page. But yeah, there is mention of like it being blended with Mavra for the sweet wine.
Comandaria.
Comandaria. Yeah, which is a fun thing to say. That is a fun thing to say.
So Zinisteri is an interesting grape, and some of these guys really know how to play with it. In fact, I was at a winery called the Silicon, and they have what they call the KAI project. They are three different vineyards that they have at three different ages. So the first one, and then three different areas. One of the vineyards is 12 years old. One of the vineyards is 65 years old, and the other vineyard is 102 years old. And it's amazing what a 102 year old Zinisteri tastes like. That was totally an eye opener for this grape variety, because you didn't see a lot of 102 year old wines or vines because of the rip up, but these guys had some, which was really nice to see. And then we get into, and another white is called Promara. Go ahead, look it up. But Zinisteri is like their number one white grape. That's the one that they have the most of on the island. Like, I think 27% or something like that of the island is Ginastere. And a lot of winemakers are very excited by it. Then you get Promara, which is another white grape. I think we tried one. It's interesting. You'd have to taste more of it, right, to get any kind of idea or a proper understanding of that grape. So, sadly, I can't really tell you much about Promara other than, you know, it's a white grape.
Sorry, how do you spell it? Because, like, I'm taking a look here. Like, there's a chart that has, like, all the grapes plant. I guess of many of the grapes planted. It goes as Ginastere, Mavro, Carignan, Shiraz,
Maraffetico.
Yep, thank you. Cabernet, Mataro, Lefkada, Chardonnay, Othelmo, Malaga.
Yeah, Malaga.
Merlot, Grenache, Semillon, Alicante, Boucher, Sauvignon Blanc, Palomino, Spurdico. Oh, there it is. Promara, number 19.
Yep.
According to this, they only have like 12,148 kilos grown.
I think Promara, if I am not mistaken, again, I'm going to look through my notes here. I think there's like two, it's like 2 to 3% of what is in the ground. It's a very small number, like tiny. Not a lot of people are using it, or they're looking into propagating more of it. So, yeah, I think it's a very small, a very, very tiny amount. I'm waiting for you to come to one of my favorite grape varieties that starts with a Y. Do they have that in your list there, Andre?
Yanuti.
Yanuti, good for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yanuti, great.
So
grape.
Okay, so
great,
so a lot grape. Of so a lot of these are like varieties that don't have their own pages. I'm guessing this is the indigenous varieties that people are mucking around with there.
Yeah, so Maraffetico, really neat. I think its name is like Little Thief or Little Trickster. Little Trickster, that's what it is. So that's what the name is. Yanuti is another interesting grape variety. Tried a lot of those two grape varieties, and they're both red. And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with them. And all of them have really great acidity. That's the part that you would not expect from such a hot area. But again, we're looking at, you know, things that are grown at 1,100, 700, 800, 1,100, 1,200 meters, and they're keeping that acidity.
I love that. I think that's something that, like, just to hear, like to hear the, you know, how you're able to manage the vineyards with elevation and just with what Mother Nature's given you and hold that acidity. So what you're telling me is like what I have in my mind of like opulent, juicy wines. If I head to Cyprus, I might be a little disappointed if that's what I'm expecting, but might be pleasantly surprised with finding some very like food friendly and refreshing wines there.
Well, if you go with, you know, the international varieties. I think I sent you a picture of a Chardonnay.
I was waiting for that, but like, I mean, go ahead.
And I sent you the picture, and you write and I never wrote back to you because I was like, meh.
Oh, wasn't that great?
It was okay. It was not anything that I was like, wow, this you got to get, you know, Chardonnay from this. It's high altitude. Yeah. It spends 2 years in barrel. The young one was really nice. The 2022. I'm just looking at some notes here. It was bright. It was young. It was fresh. But you know, it really didn't scream, wow, I really need this Chardonnay. And then they had a four-year-old version that was, you know, kind of walnut character, butterscotch, like too much oak.
Yeah.
So,
you know what? That was the experience that I had in Abruzzo as well, is like, you know, I think we've said on the podcast like many times that, you know, Chardonnay is a bit like a weed, like it'll grow anywhere in the world, like because it is neutral and it's adaptable to climate. But what I find is in regions where Chardonnay is a bit of an outlier, I think winemakers there have the tendency to just lean towards using a bit too much oak. Like, that's what I found in Abruzzo. I saw that a little bit in Alto Adige, but it was more in Alto Adige. You kind of got the whole, you know, every color of the rainbow of treatment of Chardonnay from un-oaked to, like, over-oaked. So, I don't know. Maybe what happens in Cyprus is some of the Cypriot winemakers need to come to I4C to taste some of the rest of those.
I don't think they're bringing any Chardonnay with them. I was at a winery called Siakas.
Wait. But why do you say they wouldn't be bringing any Chardonnay with them? Like, it's just they don't make a lot of it, or just it really
like it's not a lot.
Yeah,
like it's not a lot.
Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
Again, it's not one of those varieties that they want to hang their hat on. They want to really, you know, hit home with these indigenous. And I was at a place called Siakas, Tsiakkas. And the nice part is there are about four of the wineries I did go to are being imported by Kolonaki in Ontario. And what's really interesting, when we got to Tsiakas, the guy says, "Who's the Canadian here?" And because it was all, you know, people from Europe, and I was the only North American, and I'm like, I wonder what I did wrong now. And
I mean, it's goes, you.
Yeah, it is me. So it could be anything. And I'm like, "That's me." He goes, "I got a message from our agent, and they said it's Kolonaki, and they want me to say hi to you, and anything you need, let me know." So Andre, hopefully, fingers crossed, you'll get at least a chance to try some Malefetico and some Yanuti, on a future podcast. We can swing back around.
I would love that. Sorry, the winery's at Siakas, right?
Siakas, yeah.
Yeah, so and, like, I'm taking a look here. The wines are supremely affordable. So they have Sinestri for $26.95 a bottle, Mukless Red, which is $31.95. Like, Michael, these are wines that you might actually pay for. Oh, and they have Commandaria.
Commandaria. That's usually expensive.
I don't know. Maybe we'll let's reach out to Kolonaki. I think it'd be fun to do a follow up on this to taste these wines, because I'm definitely intrigued.
So what I also found, the guy's name, and let me just, if you just give me a moment here to find his name again. Really nice guy. I want to call him Oscar, but it was Orestes, because his brother's name was Hector. So I wanted to call them Oscar and Hector, but that's not who it is. But Orestes is the winemaker. And of course, their father started the winery. It's, you know, all of these Europeans, you know, father starts it, kids take over, blah, blah, blah. But he was talking about his theory about winemaking and about how he hates new oak. And they try to keep new oak down to like 15%, because you've got to have new oak to get old oak. You can't just, you know, old oak does not just appear. But he started giving this long speech about the difference between fruit and spice, you know, how spice you get from the barrel and fruit is obviously from the fruit. And he says, if you think about it, when you get a bottle of wine and you taste oak or you taste spices, he says, fruit evolves. If you take a strawberry and you leave it on your counter, different things are going to happen to it over the course of, you know, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, blah, blah, blah. Spices don't evolve. And it really puts it into perspective that if you're drinking Chateau 2x4, Chateau 2x4 does not get better. It just continues to be Chateau 2x4.
I love that.
Whereas fruit, as long as you're getting some fruit and some good fruit out of a wine, it's going to evolve into something interesting, unique, and fabulous. So it was a really interesting take on the winemaking process.
I think also just a really good and you know, kind of a philosophical angle to what goes into a wine that I haven't really really thought about. But I do think it holds true. I think it's something it'll be interesting to talk to some of the locals about.
Well, we could bring somebody on if you want to really get into Cyprus. I'm sure there's got to be somebody I can put us on with. Oresti was great, and there's some other guys there that would be, you know, just fabulous guests to really dig deep into the Cypriot to wine culture, community.
I'm someone,
and grapes.
As much as I would love to talk to a Cypriot winemaker and have you rub it in that you got to escape winter for a little bit more time, although frankly the winter here has been pretty good. I'm someone who learns by doing, so it would be nice if we could maybe get our hands on some of these wines to taste as well, although you have painted a pretty good picture on what the wines taste like. And I mean, it's another thing too, like looking at this chart once again from Wikipedia, like you talk about how little wine they make, and it doesn't sound like there is a lot of wine being made there. Is there a lot of it going to the export market, or is most of it consumed domestically? Like what's the deal?
It's mostly domestic at the moment. They're obviously, you know, they have to start looking a little bit outward. The last few years has been about putting, you know, plants in the ground, you know, getting a wine industry that's you know, back in some semblance of order. We met with like the Ministry of Agriculture, and one of them said there's like 114 wineries. And we also had a guy with us, Michaelis, who is from Cyprus, and he's a wine writer there. He also works in cybersecurity, which is pretty interesting. And he was telling us some pretty scary stories. But anyway, one of the things that him and another couple of winemakers said is, you know, there may be 114 wineries registered, but they're not always making wine.
Oh, gotcha.
There's probably about 54 to 56 wineries that are making wine. There are 14 of the wineries who have started like their own consortium, and they're going to call their group a Wine Core, C-O-R-E. And the core stands for, hold on just a moment here. It stands for Cypriot. You gotta give me 10 seconds here, Andre.
It's fine. I mean, it's interesting to hear them organizing. Like, I'll let you pull the name of it up there. But I mean, the other thing that you like to paint the picture is like you've talked about the soil, and it sounds like soil conditions that would be great for grapes. And then you talked about the empty vineyards from the domestic grapes that were ripped up. Is there room for expansion, or is it kind of similar to Ontario? This land is going to be repurposed to somewhere else and we'll never see it turned back into a vineyard? Or like, is it an agricultural culture? Did you get the name of the consortium?
I did. So what they're going to do is they call themselves the Cyprus, so Wine Core, and it's core means Cyprus Own Roots Evolution.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
Basically what they do is they get together and they taste everybody's wines, and if people go, nope, that does not get the seal of approval of Wine Core, then you can't put the Wine Core logo on your bottle.
I mean,
like it's individual wines.
Interesting, yes or no. Like, I mean, it depends on the size of the organization. Peer review can be a good thing, but you still run the risk of, you know, a domestic cellar palate. So, like, I think it's an organization founded with good intentions, but I could see the potential for problems down the road. I mean, it's the same sort of critique that we give to VQA. I think having a benchmark for standards are good, but you need to make sure there's you know, fail safes in place to protect it from abuse.
You know, and you know, in Europe now they have the PDOs and PGIs, which are, you know, areas, and you know they're also doing you know, they have one with a tasting panel, one without. You know, Ontario is so behind on that tasting panel thing. We are so behind. Like. Anyway, we've covered it to death. But you were having another question that you were asking me there before I found that.
Yeah, just about the potential
vineyard land.
Potential, well, and potential for the industry to grow and to bounce back, like, because it sounds like it was a pretty you know, severe contraction, like from changes to the market and etc. But like you described fallow vineyards, which, you know, in theory could be replanted.
Yes, they can be replanted, and there's a want to do it. The big problem is, so we were in Siakas, and they literally built this road that's like into the mountains. They are like 1,100, 1,200 meters up, and there's this piece of land that they're looking at. It's maybe an acre, and they want to buy it. Well, the big problem is there's that it's owned by like 114 people. You know, it's that what's that French thing in Burgundy where you know somebody dies and it gets willed to all the kids and then all the grandkids and blah blah blah. So now it's owned by 114 people. Well, four of them want to sell, the other, you know, 110 don't want to sell because they think they can get more. They talk about building a house on it, and the guy goes, he's not building the house on it because I own the road. They can't even get to their piece of property, so sell me the piece of property. And they, you know, but they won't sell it because there's 114 people to deal with. And that's the kind of thing that you have there. They have these old vineyard lands that could be replanted, but people think they're going to be worth so much more. Well, they're not.
Yeah.
You know, and it's only what somebody is willing to pay for it that they're going to get. Plus, if you think about it, let's say you sell it for, you know, 10 grand, 20 grand, whatever. You know, these 114 people aren't going to get much out of 10 grand. Everybody wants, you know, their 10 grand.
So, would you go back to Cyprus?
In a heartbeat. Really liked it. As you said, winter there hadn't been that bad, but I was walking around in shorts and everybody else was telling me how crazy I was for doing that. But, you know, I'm Canadian, for God's sake. So that's what we do, right? We walk around in shorts in 20 degree weather. That's, you know. But then we were up in the hills where it was 10, and I'm still walking around in shorts. And but it's really nice there. Obviously, the summers are hot, and tourism is the big thing there. We stayed at two hotels. We stayed at the Royal Apollonia, which is a really nice hotel, and then we stayed at the Four Seasons.
Oh wow!
Which, believe it or not, is not part of the Four Seasons chain. There is a story here, but a really ritzy high end. They really live up to the Four Seasons name, although it's not a Four Seasons as part of the chain. I guess the guy who started the hotel wanted the name Four Seasons, called it the Four Seasons, and then they went to court. And he said, well, look, the logo's different, everything's different. And I think the ruling is that the Four Seasons can't go to Cyprus, and these guys who own the Four Seasons in Cyprus can't move out of Cyprus. So that's the whole deal. But it really is a nice, like, it's a nice hotel.
I'm taking a look here. It's a luxury hotel, Limassol.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. It's,
yeah. It was really, really nice. Really nice.
Well, I'm a bit jealous, as usual, when you get to travel without me, but it sounds like you behaved yourself.
We always travel without each other. I don't know. We're talking about Kentucky. I think that would be so much fun.
We still got to find a way to pull that together. I've got to find the time to do that. Opening up a bakery takes up a lot of time.
I think Kentucky would be great. I think you'd have more fun than I would, but I think it'd still be fun. And I like barbecue, though, so we could do a
Michael, you know, Kentucky's not big about barbecue. Come on.
Yes, it is.
No,
we'll make sure it is.
No, it's not. Come on. It's what's one of the world's biggest fried chicken chains? What's Kentucky known for?
Barbecue?
Fried chicken. We can go look. We can go on a mission for the Colonel. We'll go find the Colonel's grave. Although he may have been buried in Canada. Anyways, thank you for taking the time to connect so late at night. I know you're waiting for your bus. Which airport are you in? Because like the Wi-Fi is amazing. Like, you sound amazing on this.
It's Bologna, believe it or not. Well, there's nobody here, right? I would suspect if it was busier, like it was like, you know, 5 in the afternoon, I bet you, you know, the Wi-Fi would be cackling in and out. But I mean, I think I'm one of... I see 10 people.
Yeah, there's like a dude over your left shoulder that looks like he might be taking a pee or something from the way it's framed. The shot's framed.
Oh, okay. Could be. Yeah, could be. Wouldn't be surprised.
All right. Well,
some guy did come up to me and go, "Where's the bathroom?" And I'm like, "Not here."
I think we're going to be connecting again with you on the road, because like you've been gone for quite a while. I think this is something is like a lot of people don't realize, is that you and I have actually had our it together quite nicely on the podcast for a little while, but I think we have to connect again while you're away, because you've got some other wine travel lined up, right?
Yes, I do. Actually, I got some really interesting things that I'm doing. I got the Anteprima Toscana that's coming up. I'm going to go to Slow Wine Bologna, which might be interesting. And I'm actually, do you know who Massimo Bottura is?
I do not.
So he's one of the greatest chefs in Italy, or if not the world. But anyway, he's opened up a barbecue restaurant.
Oh, yes. You were talking about that. He's a Michelin Guide three-star chef, I believe.
Yes. For his, I can't remember what his name of his three-star Michelin restaurant is, but I'm going to go to this one called, I thought of Anya when I saw the name of it. It's called Al Gatto Verde.
The green cat.
The green cat.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
And it's barbecue. So I guess his wife is American, and she loves barbecue. And now he's trying to do barbecue American slash Italian style. And if you go to his Al Gatto Verde menu, there's the tasting menu. That's what I'm going to do, is the tasting menu.
Well, good luck with that.
There somewhere.
That sounds great. I think on that note, it's as any place as any to wrap the podcast.
I'll find barbecue anywhere I can. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward to hearing whether or not it's going to be good. I'm Andre Prue from underwinereview.ca. Follow me on social media at Andre Wine Review. And as always, patreon.com/twoguystalkingwine helps us keep the lights on. Because while Michael is traveling, it's on someone else's dime, and it was very nice of the Cyprus wine people to invite you to their lovely country.
Yeah, you can find, I posted from every winery I was at, so you can find me at The Grape Guy on Instagram, and there's some nice stuff there. I'm Michael Pincus of MichaelPincusWineReview.com. You can find me on social media, as I said, as The Grape Guy or Michael Pincus on Facebook. Andre, it's a pleasure to see you. You don't look any different.
Sounds good. Take us away.
And actually here, it's good morning.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to Two Guys Talking Wine on iTunes.
Two Guys Talking Wine is produced by Jim Ray, Adam Duran, and Ken Little.